and welcome to That Makes Total Sense, the podcast where we talk about faith, finance, and everyday life in a way that makes total sense. I'm your host, Alexis Busetti. On this podcast, you'll hear the personal stories of friends I'll be interviewing who are doing familiar things in new and innovative ways. We'll answer questions specifically about money and our relationship with it, and we'll explore faith and Bible teaching together. In all of these, it's not about changing our convictions as much as it is about messing with our methods. We'll have a lot of moments here together where we pause, then say, "That makes total sense." Hi, I'm Alexis Busetti, and welcome to That Makes Total Sense. I am so excited right now to bring you these back-to-back conversations with my good friend, Michelle McKinney of Dreams Unleashed. Michelle is the founder, she's the CEO, and she is the lead dream architect of her company, Dreams Unleashed, where she specifically helps women to identify and live out their God-given goals and dreams. And I am just so excited to bring her to you. You are going to love her. In this first episode, Michelle gets personal with us, and I asked her to share some things about her story that have made her who she is and have built her faith up to where it is now. And in the second episode, she is going to give us a mini free coaching session. She's going to take us through some of the things that she does with her clients to help them identify where they are and help them get to where they want to be. So enjoy this. Here is my first conversation with my good friend, Michelle. Michelle, thank you so much for coming on to That Makes Total Sense. I really, really appreciate it.
No, my gosh, thank you. I'm so excited to be here. So I'm looking forward to wherever this conversation leads us.
Awesome. So because we are recording this for the audience, I want to let everyone know that Michelle and I are friends in real life. And so I know
we are.
I told you guys a little bit about that when I introduced her in the opening, but we're going to try and keep our conversation where it's going to be really applicable to the audience, because we could go a lot of places today, Michelle. We could go
a whole lot of places.
But the thing that really struck me, and the reason that I really wanted to have Michelle on the show, is because I was trying to think, besides her amazing work that she does with women and their businesses and their dreams, which we're going to talk about in the second episode with Michelle, I was trying to think, what was it that really drew me to her as a friend? Because she is an incredible coach. She's an incredible businesswoman. She is all these things. You are, girl. But I think it is your faith. That was that intangible thing that drew me to you as a person and as a friend.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. That means a lot.
Well, one of the first times that you and I really chatted and we prayed together, I want to tell this story before we get going. I was telling my kids, because we were praying about it, praying about something later. And I said, "Listen, guys, mommy met a new friend." And my girlfriend, Michelle, when she prays, first of all, when she prays, God listens. I mean, anybody who's around listens.
Oh, man.
But you may not even remember this, and you did it several times, but the first time you prayed and you thanked God that you woke up this morning.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
you thanked him that we woke up, that we have breath, that we have limbs that move. I mean, come on. Like, can we do that? You know, can we just thank God, you know, instead of, you know, just coming straight to him with, "God, this is what I want. This is what I need. This is where I want you to move." It's like, "Lord, thank you that I even can move today." You know, it's his mercy and it's his grace that even gives us breath. And so that was my introduction to you, Michelle, and your faith was,
thank you.
He got you up this morning. And he
thank you, child. Absolutely.
So a few of the things that I was chatting with Michelle about that I'd love for her to tell you is just a little bit, some milestones in her life story. So Michelle, are you open to going way back? Like way back?
Willing to go way back.
Can you tell us, can you tell us a little bit about your childhood and specifically about this milestone that I'm talking about with your mom? Because not everybody has heard you tell this story, but it is so impactful and so powerful.
Yeah, for sure. So my brother and I, we by birth have the same mother, different father, but our father, who is my biological father, is the only father that he's known. And so we grew up with both of our parents up until probably around about, I was four, getting ready to turn five. My mom, as a four-year-old, you know, went upstairs to go wake her up or whatever room it was in that she was in. And my mom was non-responsive. And so, you know, four-year-old didn't know really what to do. So I ran downstairs to get my dad. The deal is that my dad was also an alcoholic. And so he had been challenged. And these are the things that, you know, as I came into my understanding, because there's the space that shame can take up that took up my life for a really long period of time about talking about that part of my dad's life. And so once I got older and began to understand more of his story, and this is after his passing, so this isn't necessarily because my dad explained it, but I just thank God for other people who are Titus II or older women in my life who've helped to give me perspective about life. Right. And so, you know, when I take into account the fact that my dad was a Vietnam vet who, like many other, you know, people who went over to serve, not understanding the conditions in which they were going to serve, came back home and were expected to live a normal life after seeing so many atrocities. And it was very difficult, you know, even now for military men and women to come back into civilian life, having seen like the worst of the worst of human horrors, and then be expected to be loving and kind, generous and gentle husbands and wives and mothers and all those things. And so my dad, I think like many others, came back to the States and didn't know how to cope with all of that. Right. And so what he took to was alcohol. Other people took to other things, you know, even today in life, we all have some kind of a vice that we may have dealt with at some point in our life. So that was my dad. So my dad, anyway, he wasn't necessarily, you know, of the biggest help that I can remember at that time. And so the ambulance came. We were living with my aunt and my uncle at the time. They took my mom to the local hospital. And that was where her last place was at the hospital. And so I remember when they called my aunt, my uncle, who was my dad's brother and his wife, over to bring me to be able to get the news. I walked into the townhouse, and when I got to the townhouse, I was 4 years old, but you know, that's the thing, is that people don't understand that children, even at four and at three, are very aware of what's happening. They may not be able to put words to it or to understand it, but they are very aware and can sense and feel what's going on around them. And so when I walked into the first floor of the townhouse, there were adults down there and everybody looked really somber. And then I went upstairs, which is where I was being directed by whoever the adult was. I got up to the top of the stairs. I kind of looked around before I hit the very top, and I saw my brother and my dad in the room. And my brother is 5 years older than me. And so, of course, I was four. He was already 10 at the time. I was getting ready to have a birthday. And I walk into the room, and my dad says to me, "Michelle, tell your brother to stop crying." And so when my dad told me to tell my brother to stop crying, you know, what that said to me, even though those were not the words that he spoke, was that it is not okay to cry through this devastating loss in your life. And so even though that wasn't what his intention was, he was just doing the best that he knew how to do as a grieving spouse also, and a grieving father watching his kids, that was just the words that he knew to use. He didn't have the right words. And so I took those words and I carried them with me all the way into my adulthood. "Michelle, don't cry." And so the way that I dealt with challenges and problems that came my way is that I internalized it a lot, which, because I internalized it so much, some of that led to quite a few bouts with suicidal thoughts and trying to figure out how do I cope with this life and this new normal. And so those things were quite challenging, you know, to say the least. But God had just continually been faithful.
Michelle, thank you. Like, thank you, because I'm listening to this and I'm just going, I mean, you have such a perspective, but obviously it has taken you some time and some time with the Lord to get there. You know, I have an uncle who I never met because he came home from Vietnam, similarly to how you described your dad. And you know, the story that I got was that he was living either with or close to my grandparents at the time, in the late 70s. And he said he was going to the store. And he left and he never came back. And,
wow,
you know, because he had, he had dealt with some problems as a result of the war and the atrocities that those men and women saw when they were there. And so I just think the perspective that you have, you know, and when you're talking about your dad, the other phrase that kept going through my mind is, you know, yes, tragic when, you know, the entire story, but just your perspective of, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but the phrase that came to my mind is he was doing the best he could with what he had, you know, how he was just relating to you and your brother and to the rest of the family at that time. And so thank you for sharing that, because what you said at the beginning, that you had dealt with shame regarding that for a while, it's, you know, shame grows in the dark, right? And underground in places where we can't talk about it. And so it's huge for you to tell that story. And I just appreciate it so much, because we may not have the same story. We most likely don't, but we all have some things in our family's history that we wish were different, but they're not.
And let me say this, you know, about what you're talking about, right? The thing is that from even the words that you just recited, that, you know, that I shared in terms of he was doing the best that he knew how to do, right? I didn't get that language until I'm like, I had to forget sometimes how old I am. I think I'm 43 now. And so I didn't get that language until I was maybe about 40. And it was a woman who is a mother to me now, or named Lucille Ely. And we were at her, I was at her house and just talking through, you know, just still processing all of the stuff that happened, you know, growing up and not having my mom and how much I missed her. And she also happened to have a daughter who died of a aneurysm, which is what my mom died of, right? And there were some other things that happened in the space of that with my family. But the deal was that when she gave me that language, you know, and I, after explaining the story, she was like, Michelle, you know, you don't know what quality of life, had your mother lived, had God decided to allow your mom to live beyond that aneurysm, you don't know the quality of life that she would have had, and or would your dad have even been capable to provide for you and your brother. Because the other part of that story is that my mom was very young. She was 30 years old. And so she did not have a will. You know, granted, that's no reason not to have a will. But, you know, the truth of the matter is many of us don't have necessarily wills that state, if something were to happen to me and or my spouse, this is what's supposed to happen to the children. You know, when you are 30, when you are in your 20s, you don't think about that in that space. And so she didn't, you know, she wasn't in that mind frame. And so because there wasn't a will in place, there was a lot of, and the way in which my mom died, because there's another piece to it too, there was a lot of hurt and anger within the two families, meaning my mom's side of the family and my dad's side of the family. And so with that hurt and the anger and not having a will in place, what happened was I went with one side of the family and my brother went with another side of the family, which was basically in many regards, you know, both sides of the family had both best interests at heart, right? Apparently my mom had made some wishes, but she did not document them on paper when she was sick. And so along with people looking to try to make the best decision, they were also making a decision out of hurt, right? And so in order to appease and try to comfort the hurt and pain that they were feeling. It was, well, we'll take one kid and we'll take the other, right? And that caused a lot with me. And that's where I think some of the suicidal thoughts and things like that, you know, came to play, because right after my mom died, her birthday was September 26th. She died September 7th. My birthday was October 4th. So much stuff was happening around that time. And there was not a conversation with me or my brother, you know, from well-meaning adults, about how are you all processing this and how do you feel? It was more so, okay, let's get you guys in school. You stay here, you stay there. And there wasn't a processing of understanding that all in one swoop, we lost everything that was family to us, our home, everything was just gone just immediately. And so, you know, it was, my mom was no longer here and I didn't know how to process that as a 4-year-old getting ready to turn 5. My brother, who was, who I woke up to every morning, he was not going to be there anymore. My dad was not going to be there anymore. And we were just expected to move about life. And so that's where there was just a lot of challenge of figuring out what my identity was. And so the beauty in that now is that as we allow time and as we also bring people into our lives who are able to pour into us also, it helps with being able to tell your story from a place of power and not one of pain. Because I used to tell my story from a place of pain and shame, where it was, you know, this is the end of my story, you know, that's it. But now I'm able to tell it from a place of, these are all the things that happened, but I'm still standing. And I'm not still standing like, woe is me. I'm standing and I'm like, wow, God, if you brought me through all of this, right? Whatever I'm going through right now or will go through, you have been so faithful that I know you're going to carry me through that too. And there's been some doozies. I mean, because that in and of itself was a fundamental beginning doozy, but there have been so many other, as you call them, milestone things that have happened over the course of life that is just like, I can't believe that God still chooses me to stand even in spite of all this stuff that has transpired. And all of it is not necessarily the doings of other people. Some of it is my own doing too.
Well, I mean, true for all of us. I mean, some of it is, but I love what you said. It's like going over and over in my head to tell our story from a place of power instead of from a place of pain. And that's not rejecting the pain or saying that the pain didn't exist or doesn't exist, but you know, two things came to my mind. One is telling your story from a place of power means that you get to help decide what place that story has in your life. You know, like you said, this could have been the end. You could be telling that story and as a fatalist and say, nope, this is it. This is over. But I also think with you, something that I see, as your friend is that I feel like you tell all of your stories from a place of God's power over your own pain.
All day.
Right? All day.
All day long.
All day.
All day long is his. I mean, I may not, you know, we all have our different seasons of life. There are seasons where, you know, there's like that people say the ebbs and the flows, right? And so in those ebbs and flows, I may not be like a, you know, look how amazing I, you know, there may be like a bit, bits of depression or sadness and, sure, you know, longing and all those things that exist in my humanness. At the same time, I'm grateful, quite honestly, that I have less of those and more of the other. And it's really just because of what I choose to focus on. You know, scripturally, where it talks about meditate on these things, you know, that are lovely, of good rapport, all those things. You get to choose. You may not get to choose what happens in your life, you know, in terms of the challenges that come through. You may not get to choose that, but you do get to choose what you're going to meditate on. And
say
the thing
again.
Is, whatever you
say
get to
again.
Choose what you meditate on.
Right. Say it again.
And whatever you...
You met
for
me.
Alexis, you get to choose what you meditate on.
Yep.
And the thing is, whatever you meditate on, that's what will be magnified.
Yeah.
And so I want to magnify, you know, because there's so much more that God wants to do in my life, that if I stay in a space of meditating on the negative and the pain that's happening, and it does have its place, right? Because even scripture, you know, there's places where David, you know, where he put on his cloak and ashes and he mourned for a period of time. And then he got to a place, you know, when his son was sick, he got to a place where he was like, you know what? I got to take off the sackcloth and ashes, yep. and I got to get up and wash myself. Yep. And now let me move on. Right. And so that's, I think that's where the balance comes, is that you have to feel the grief and you have to process the grief of whatever the loss is. Right. And loss doesn't always have to be a physical person. It could be the loss of a dream. But being able to give yourself time to process that grief and that pain, but then also making a decision to say, we're not going to stay here, right? And it doesn't mean that there aren't times that I don't miss my mom, you know, that there are different milestones, sure. like great milestones that happen in my life, you know, whether it's graduation from high school, giving birth to my first child, you know, my children going to college. Those are all the things that when they happen, I'm like, man, I wish my mom was here. But at the same time, instead of staying in that place, it's like, Mom, you know, how incredible this legacy that you left here. I would love for you to have joined me in this space, but just the legacy that I am living out because of even in a short period of time, she only had 4.5 years with me. In a 4.5 years time frame that God allowed her to be here, she was able to plant some roots in me that long outlived that shortness of time that we had with one another.
Oh, I love that so much. And I wanna touch really briefly because, like you said, this is not fatalistic. That was not the end of your story. A lot of people who know you from your business, who know you from Dreams Unleashed, may not even know some of the turns in your personal life that are related to this legacy of your mom. And the two that I'm thinking of, okay, the big one I'm thinking of is about 7 years old-ish. She is your only girl. I mean, you have some boys. And I have some boys too. I love my boys. But she's your only girl. And so Michelle is an adoptive mom. The first time we talked, I think we didn't realize each other. We both had adopted kiddos and each of us have adopted from Africa, which is incredible. But Sayla is who I'm thinking of number one. But then number two, also a lot of people may not realize the work that you get to do with National Angels. And so, I mean, if you can just even just touch on those things, and I'm thinking as a perspective of as that legacy that your mom gave you, but also as a progressive part of your faith, as a persistent and persevering part of your faith, that those things that affected you and had real impact on your life, there is real fruit growing from those spaces. There's real fruit. So tell us whatever you want us to know about those couple of things. And I say things, but Sayla, girl.
So I'm going to come from a worldview first because of something I recently saw. And I'm not going to talk about where I got it from because people figure out where they got it, you know, if they watch it themselves. It's a documentary I recently watched like 2 days ago, right? And the thing that struck me, it's this documentary about data and about, you know, a data breach that happened nationally, you know, or happened domestically rather, right? And so one of the things that was shared was that one of the tactics of an individual was that they wanted to get people to allegedly to be able to do what they wanted them to do, to make a decision based on their preference, right? And so this is what the strategy said. It said, in order to change society, you must first break it so that you can mold it to what you want it to be, right? So what the context of that was that if we can break society by making people to fight with one another, right? To focus on what's so different about one another, then we break it so that they then become at odds with one another, right? So there is great division among the land, right? So then what that took me to is just the idea of who God is. Like at the end of the day, what is it? What is his big idea? His big idea is reconciliation, period, right?
Amen.
And so when I heard that and I thought about just nationally and even globally where we are as nations is that there's so much division. And really, I believe that the only thing that will heal the division in the lands is reconciliation, right? And restoration. And so when I when I saw that and I heard that, and when I think about my own life, you know, you talk about these two milestones, one being my adoption and then the work that I do with National Angels, it reminds me of just how much of a restore and how much God is into reconciliation. Because there was a period of time, like I said, that, you know, my story was about, you know, my mom died, my dad wasn't able to take care of us. And so my parents, my aunt and my uncle ended up being my guardians, who I also called my mom and dad. But, you know, when I was graduating from high school, it was very clear because of a document that they had to file in order for me to go to college. And in order for me to go to college, they had to file a document that said I was a ward of the court, right? Wow. And being a ward of the court, when you see that on paper, and I understand why we did it, it was the right thing to do, right? But when you see that on paper, that the state considers you to be a ward of the court, meaning you have no parents that are able to take care of you. And so you are basically governed by the state, right? And right. You are in care of someone else. So when I first, and I actually still have that paperwork just because it's just a part of my story. And I want to continue to have it as a reminder of who God is. And so when you see that document that you are a ward of the court and that you are basically an orphan because it goes through orphan court, is that I told my story again from the space of I didn't have my parents, right? And mm-hmm. So somebody else, my aunt, my uncle, thank God, decided to raise me. And so it was from that space of, man, you know, I'm missing XYZ. And so I would have never, there was times later on in my life where I was like, you know, it might be kind of good to be able to do foster care. That was the extent of it, right? And then I got married, and Tony and I, we started having kids, and so we had our first two. We had Caleb Makai. That whole idea about foster care went out the window because my kids got to an age where they were able to go downstairs on Saturday and make their own cereal, yes, and I was like, we're not having any more kids. We done, right?
All and of my so kids can buckle themselves in their car seats. I'm like, all right, we're done.
Girl,
not doing
milestone, right?
Milestone, yep.
Right. And so that became, this is what I want. And so what God challenged me with right around when he was stirring my heart for adoption was, but you didn't ask me what did I want. Oh. This life is not yours. It does not belong to you. I am stewarding this life to you, Michelle. You get the opportunity to live out the story that I created before you were even born and before you were thought of, right, in terms of with your mom and your dad. Right. And so, you know, that humbled me a whole lot. And it's like, okay, God, well, what you trying to say? Talk to your daughter. What's up? And so around that time, I started seeing, you know, these different stories of people who had adopted, and it wasn't just domestic anymore. It was about international adoption. And the first people that I saw were, I think it was Carlos Whitaker and his wife. And then after that, it was another couple who were not African-American, didn't look like me, who had adopted from Ethiopia. And all the other families that I saw that were in that space that were adopting from African nations, they didn't look like me, right? And so I'm just going to be very honest. This is Michelle, right? So, you know, when you get me, you get the honesty of who I am, right?
That's what we want.
So this grown-up Black girl would look at these stories of people who did not look like me. And I would honestly say, oh, those are good for the white people that they are going into, you know, these different places and they are adopting. I'm just telling you, in my space, that's where I was, because I didn't see myself as a part of that story, because there was nobody else that I knew of at the time that was doing that. Because the truth of the matter was that in terms of what I knew was that it wasn't that African Americans were not adopting. It was that it looked different.
Yes.
It was that more families in terms of an African American communities, whether in the States or in other places, they end up taking in family members, you know?
Right.
So if
just
a
like
parent or a sister, a sibling can't, exactly, just like mine, they can't, that person can no longer take care of their children. So that cousin or that sister, that auntie takes that child in, right? So it just looked very different. So I just didn't know about,
right.
You know,
very
or wasn't,
active.
Didn't have an awareness.
Very active in
right?
the adoption foster care community, but a lot of it is not technically with papers signed and stuff like that. At least that was
absolutely.
My experience when I was in social work, was so, so active in loving on kids and adoption and foster care in that realm of the world. But like you're saying, it mm-hmm. did, it looks different kind of.
It looked very different.
Yeah.
And in the space of domestic, there, you know, granted, I knew people that adopted domestically, right? that adopted private or, you know, through foster care through adoption. So I knew about that space, but in terms of international adoption, so that just wasn't even a thing that I ever considered that would be part of our family story until God started breaking, you know, down the pieces and building, breaking down the walls in my own heart. And it went from looking at other people's stories who didn't look like me to saying, wait a minute now, I was writing a blog post. This is when I first had my very, very first blog. And I remember writing a bucket list. Now, granted, I've said this before, adoption is not something you put on a bucket list, but I was writing down the things that I wanted to do. I was writing down all the things that I wanted to do. And when I was writing, I was typing on the keyboard, actually, and it said, one day, maybe adopt from a foreign nation, right? And whatever the words were, it was very similar to that. When I got to that last keystroke, my fingers jumped off the keyboard. Who said that? That where that come from, right? Then my thought was, well, that's not going to happen, Lord. If that's you, that's not going to happen because my husband's never going to agree. Not only are we talking about adoption, but now you're talking about international adoption. He's not going to agree to that. We never even had that conversation. If you remember, our conversation was, we're done with kids, you know, and we're going to raise our kids that we have. They're getting a little bit more independent, so we're done. Well, lo and behold, because as he says, our ways, his way, our ways are not his ways, and his thoughts are not our thoughts, is that he began to, unbeknownst to me, he was already planting the seeds in my husband's heart, you know, to be able to be open to this idea. And so I was on a sabbatical from work because I'd hurt myself for a period during that time. And I said, okay, well, I'm going to ask him today. And so not knowing what, you know, what God had been doing, I was surely just knew he was going to say no. So he ended up, he got in the house and I was like, hey, we're having a conversation. And I asked him about it. He was like, yeah, we should do that. And I was like, wait a minute now.
Wait a minute now.
I was like, wait a minute now. Right? But the thing is, even with that, this is what I tell women sometimes when my learning lesson from it is that I think a lot of times that in those situations where the woman, you know, has the idea first of the adoption and then she's waiting for her husband to come along with it, I think in my own scenario anyway, that because I'm so headstrong, if God would have given it to him first, and then he had to come my way to get, let's say, the agreement with it, I would have gave him a hard way to go. I'm telling you, I know me, I would have, right?
And that's so actually God really did. Resonating with me right now because I had, it is because, well, because in our adoption, we actually always thought we would adopt, but when it came down to the time frame and when we were actually going to get started and all of that stuff, it was me. And I've always felt really backwards about that. But when you just said that, I thought, okay, Michelle, you know what? That's probably it for me too, because I can tend to be slightly headstrong as well.
No, not you.
I know it's shocking. It's shocking. But yeah, so I can relate to that. I can relate to that. So go ahead.
Yep. No, you're fine. And so, you know, just because I'm appreciative of the fact that God did it that way because he was privately doing that work in his heart as he was challenging me because I was coming like, remember I said, oh, that's nice for those people over there.
For them.
That's nice. That's great that y'all are doing that. And he's like, wait a minute. You are them people. You are them. And he had to convince me that we were because I had all the reasons why we were. One was because, you know, with me, like I said, you're going to get the real, this is what it is, right? I've said this before is that when it comes to adoption, right, whether private adoption in the U.S. or whether it is international, it's expensive. And so for Ethiopian adoption at the time when we were just starting, it was maybe about $28,000, right? And I've said this before. I was the girl that was calling Pepco trying to figure out how to break up my payments so my lights weren't getting shut off. And so it was like $28,000. That don't even make sense, guys.
That's how not chump change.
We don't got that. We don't have that. That there's no savings, you know, there's no 401k that can just, you know, be expunged and we just turn that over that way, right? And so that was one reason. And then I started to have all the other reasons in my head. Okay, God, my credit score is nice. They checking for credit and stuff like that, your background, I'm not going to pass that test either, right? So I had told myself all the reasons and God too, why we weren't the right candidates. And so
how interested was God in hearing that?
Girl, he was like, okay, and what? Okay. Well, okay. So you want to tell me all this, and I'm the one that created the world from nothing. Okay.
Right.
Okay.
I was just checking. If he was real.
Let's see how this goes. So, yeah, so that was, you know, so those are, I think a lot of times when we are called to do things that are outside of our realm, whatever they are in terms of what we can do in our own capacity, we try to talk ourselves out of and second guess whether or not God's called us to that thing. And he's like, I'm just asking you, will you allow me to use you? He's not always asking us to come up with the resources to do it. He just wants to know, will you be, and we hear it all the time, but sometimes it's hard for it to resonate and how it applies. Can I be your hands and feet? You know, will you be my hands and feet for this work that I want to empower you to do? That's all I'm at. That's the permission I'm asking for. That's the part I'm asking you to do. I will do the hard stuff. But will you be the front man for me in this work that I want to do through you? And that's what it was. And so to see how he did this, and back to that reconciliation part, here I was in that my initial story was, I am, you know, this orphan person. And God was like, no, that's not the end of the story. The third day part of your story is that it didn't just stop there. The third day redeeming part of your story is that you will be the mother also of an orphan child who will have a story that you will understand the pain, but also the power in that story. And you will be able to help her to walk through those feelings, those same feelings that you had of abandonment that made you feel like you wanted to take your life. You'll be able to understand some pieces in that story as she grapples with, as she gets older, what are the pieces of my story and how do I show up? And so that work, again, also shows up with National Angels, which National Angels, run by Susan Ramirez, who I love so much, more than words can express. The work that I do with them is I am one of a handful of people that sit on an advisory council where they come alongside families who take in children who are in foster care and love them deeply. And so National Angels comes alongside of these families in the way of a love box that is a very intentional sort of gift of practical things and just thoughtful things that the children and the caretakers of the children would need, but then also through another program that they have that empowers them to get the skills that sometimes children in foster care just may not have because they don't have that consistent guiding adult as they are in the system to know, how do I open up a checking account? What is a savings account? Right. How do I balance a book? When do I go get a driver's license? Oh my gosh, I didn't know that in the United States, that the state that I live in, because I am a child that has been in foster care, that I may actually be able to go to any in-state school, any in-state college, free of charge.
Right.
How do I do all those things?
Right.
And so that's why I love National Angels so much, because that thread of foster care is still a part of my story. So to see how God is redeeming the story that I thought was like, dang, I can't believe this is the story I get. And God's like, girl, that's not the end of it. I'm redeeming this. And so I'm going to use you to also be a mom of a child who has had this experience, but also to use the gifts that I've given you with strategy and being creative and all those things to come alongside this nonprofit to be able to help them in the work that they're doing.
I love it so much. And I'm going to go back to what you said, and then we're going to go forward to our next episode because you gave the perfect segue for it, which, I mean, amazing. But one of the things I thought was, you know, you've heard a lot of people say, when you thought, maybe you thought you were getting buried, you were really getting planted. And I
girl,
think
that yes, I love
the
that
pieces of fruit that are coming out of your life because of this time frame where maybe there were times you thought you were getting buried and God was planting you, and there are so many people who are benefiting from the harvest of these pieces in your life. And you gave the segue that we're going to go into our next episode. So stay tuned, everybody. But Michelle is talking about how, and she was preaching about herself, but she's preaching to us about how can we be God's hands and feet. He said, you're going to be the front man. You're going to be the front man for some of these things. And now this is all Michelle's personal, but in her business life, this is what she does. This is what she does is she helps us. She helps you. She helps women understand how are we going to be the leading lady, the front person in these plans that God has for our lives, but to impact the people around us. Because we look at ourselves sometimes and we say, oh, that's good for them. Oh, that's great for those people. And God looks at us and says what he says to Michelle, which is, you are those people. So get ready for what I'm about to do. So Michelle, thank you for sharing your heart, for sharing your story, for being so tender with us. Everybody stay tuned. Remember, this is not the end of our time with Michelle. This is just the beginning. We're going to the next episode. You're going to want to tune in because we're going to switch the focus and she is going to talk to you, our listener, and she's going to give us a little mini coaching session. And I have been inside of these. Oh, I have been inside of these in real life. You know, I have, and I won't cry this time. I always cry when it's just me and Michelle, but I won't cry this time, but it's because she's pulling out of me and she's pulling out of us things that we know that God has planted in us so that we can impact the world around us. So stay tuned. If you loved this episode with Michelle, just wait because it is going to get even better. So thank you again so much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe so you won't miss an episode. Share the link with your friends. You can visit us at thatmakestotalsense.com. And until next time, this is Alexis Busetti, remembering to do well for ourselves so we can do good for others. Bye.